Okay, well, welcome to the June call, everybody. This is Mark Reynolds. I'm calling you from the Omni Shore. I'm in Washington, D.C., where our international conference is happening. The most people we've ever had for one of these June conferences is 1,300 people. As of pre-registration, there's 1,541 people registered for the conference. So I'll be letting the other people know who are here as they arrive tomorrow morning. But I just want to give the, for those of you who are out in the field who won't be coming, a feel for what will be happening here in DC. So first of all, 1,541 people registered. We have over 500 meetings scheduled. There are 380 people who have identified themselves as students. So a lot of students coming. There are 72 minors, so a lot of people are bringing their high schoolers and junior hires, and even some grade school. There are 678 people who are new to the organization, so there's a training. That's, you know, more than our first five or six conferences, so that's going to be just fantastic. There are 12 regional coordinators, 42 state coordinators. There are 362 group leaders and 342 liaisons. We also have by far the most diverse conference we've ever had. We have 175 people who identify themselves as people of color, and it's just so excited that more and more everyday organization starts to look like our country and reflect what the country looks like. We have 129 people who identify themselves as right of center, and 76 of them are part of our conservative caucus. 31 of our action teams are here. We'll be having three keynote sessions and 104 breakouts, so there's going to be a lot of activities. And of the possible congressional districts covered, last year was the most congressional districts we ever covered. This year, it was at 82%. This year, 87% of the congressional districts are covered. So we have a huge opportunity to have constituents actually working with their member of Congress to push our legislation down the road. Okay, good. So we're very excited that one of our most important partners and guests is back with us today, Dr. Shiling Su. Shiling has been a keynote speaker at our conference. He's spoken at a lot of our regional conferences. He's an important member of our advisory board. I would just say that if there was only one book you were ever going to read on carbon pricing, his book, The Case for a Carbon Tax, Getting Past Our Hang-ups to Effective Climate Policy, is the one I would recommend reading. There's a lot of really good books on carbon pricing, but if you were only going to read one, this is the one that I would recommend that you read. I think it just makes the case for people, particularly like me, that does not have a background in economics. It gives me a lot of ways of thinking about this that I can go then articulate to other people that I'm working with. He's also teaches and writes in the areas of environmental and natural resource law, climate change, law and economics and property. Professor Su holds an MS in ecology and a PhD in agricultural and research economics, and was an EPA Star Fellow from 1996 to 1998. And so let me just start, Shiling, because you've actually been on the Hill with us before. And we'll be having, you know, 1,500 people headed to the Hill on Tuesday. And would you mind just talking before we get into some of the economic issues? What was that experience like for you being on Capitol Hill, meeting with members of Congress as a part of a grassroots effort?
Oh, it was terrific. I really loved being a part of it. I love being part of everything Citizens Climate Lobby does. But that was really special, I think. You know, especially these days when we feel like people are just at each other's throats if there's disagreement. I felt like the Citizens Climate Lobby approach was just the best thing. The emphasis on approaching members of Congress and their staff with respect and politeness, you could kind of tell it took them aback as well. I think they're used to a much more coarse method of kind of talking to each other. So, yeah, I thought that was just the right thing. And it kind of, you know, sometimes when I think about the disagreements that I have and the obstacles that we face in talking about climate change and carbon taxes, I get a little hot under the collar. So being around other Citizens Climate Lobby members and approaching members of Congress and their staff was really kind of had a tempering influence on me as well. So anyway, that's part of why I remain so enthusiastic about working with Citizens Climate Lobby, just because it helps me keep a lid on some of my emotions and try and focus on what'll move the ball forward.
Great. And I'll just say that you and I were in a meeting with former Speaker Ryan, and he asked a really tough question, but I wasn't exactly sure what he was asking, and you had such a great answer. It was so fantastic having you in that particular meeting. Now, so last year we saw a statement that came out of over 3,000 economists, many of them having Nobel Prizes, all the former living Fed chairs, in favor of a carbon dividend plan. Why do you think there's such overwhelming support from economists for a carbon dividend plan?
You know, I have to say that development is a little surprising, maybe not shocking. You know, I think just 3 years ago, perhaps, most economists really believed that if you were going to tax carbon, the best thing you could do with the money was to reduce corporate income taxes or taxes on other capital investments, like capital gains taxes. And the reason for that is that economists believed that, you know, the way to grow an economy is to allow money to be there for investment. Over time, probably two things have occurred. Probably economists are starting to recognize that money in the hands of people to invest isn't necessarily the best way to use that money, that corporations don't necessarily use it to create jobs. That's been something that's been a talking point on the right and the Republican side for a long time. And that's no doubt still partially true, but maybe not the kind of universally accepted truth among economists anymore. The second thing that happened is that I think economists started cluing into the politics of carbon taxation, that it is, unless you do something to try and reverse the effects on the poorest people, the people hardest hit by a carbon tax with high energy prices, that that's a political non-starter. So I don't know what all of these 3,000 economists were thinking. It almost certainly wasn't the same thing. But those are two things that probably played prominently into having economists signed off. We might not do this way if it were up to us, but a carbon tax is important enough that I'm willing to support a carbon fee and dividend plan because this just seems like the best policy moving forward. I guess, you know, there's a third thing is that inequality has gotten much, much more press in the last 3 or 4 years, that economists probably felt like, okay, this is a policy that will also make a small step towards addressing economic inequality as well. So those maybe two and a half things probably stirred a lot of economists to sign on.
Okay, cool. Thank you. So the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act has a very slight regulatory pause that essentially says we're not going to create double jeopardy. If you're pricing something, you don't regulate it at the same time. It still preserves many regulations, but it says you're not going to do both of those at the same time. Is that a good idea to create a regulatory pause in places where you're actually pricing emissions?
Well, part of that is a political question. I think part of it is like some industries would rather just have just the price and not the regulation to kind of deal with at the same time. But part of it is also practical. And I think as your volunteers approach the Hill, I think, you know, the thing to talk about is, you know, the most base important thing to do about climate change is to have that price. That's also something that you can kind of convey to people that are supportive of the Green New Deal. It's not like we can't do anything else, but the most important, simple, central thing to do is to have that price. To have a price and some regulations at the same time could have these two things working at cross purposes to each other, right? If you have a regulation that mandates, you know, pollution control equipment, that might kind of drive down the incentive to kind of reduce emissions further. I guess the way to think about it is that it's double regulating something when you only need one. And not only is that kind of burdensome for the regulated industry, but it's just harder to do from a regulatory standpoint. If you're an air pollution regulator, I mean, most clean air regulations in the United States actually work through the states. We have our own state regulatory agencies that carry out EPA's mandates. And it would be a tough sell for them to say you have to kind of regulate these emissions while keeping in mind a carbon price as well. So, you know, I'm in favor of the regulatory pause to see if we can actually drive the emissions down while we give time for the carbon price to act. But I think it would also, it just kind of makes sense from an administrative point of view. One of the big selling points of a carbon tax is, you know, it's simple, it's easy. You don't have to have the rev regulators in it. I think here, when you have state regulators trying to grapple with this and the carbon price as well, I think we would turn a lot of people off, a lot of state regulators that might ordinarily be on our side if we had to have them do double duty on something like this.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm going to open up to the chat in just a moment, but can you talk a little bit about how we should talk about the economic cost of not addressing climate change? How can we, you know, it's complex, but how can we convey it in a way that gets reaches people?
You know, I've always felt like talking about climate change and talking about carbon taxes are similar. There are these similar obstacles. If you just kind of say the economic cost is this, I'm not sure that means that much to people. I'm not sure that if you say, you know, there's going to be economic, I think one economist put it best. If you say the economy is going to be 10% smaller, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, that doesn't necessarily mean anything to them. You might even kind of rationalize it and say, look, it might be 10 or 15% smaller, but we're still going to be richer than we are now, right? So what's the big deal? I think the way to talk about like the economic costs of climate change is to focus and do the yeoman's work of focusing on the invisible things that happen. So, you know, part of what's tough about what has been tough about climate change is that it's not visible, right? The climate changes and a hurricane comes along and devastates a part of the panhandle in the state in which I live, not very far from where I live. But is that really due to climate change? You know, we don't really know. And I call that kind of an invisible effect just because it's so hard to connect it up to climate change. I think to talk about kind of climate change and carbon pricing is to say that, you know what, there are these things that happen. You can't see them happen, but they're happening. And it's a tough sell to be sure. But I think if you're, for example, you know, conversing with someone on the conservative side of the aisle, you could say that you know that economics works, you know that markets work, you know that prices have effects on people, and you know that economic growth is important. That's what's kept our engine moving for you know, the better part of our economic revolution. And so I guess to talk about the economic impacts of climate change means trying to sell them on these things that they can't see happening, but they really have to accept because, you know, our kind of the history of our, you know, economic growth is replete with examples that these things are actually happening. You know, I know we have, I think Citizens Climate Lobby is trying to be accommodating of kind of people that support the Green New Deal. But one of the things that I think that we could learn from that reaching out is that we can focus on markets and how they actually work. I had a fruitful exercise of some of our Florida volunteers at our Florida Citizens Climate Lobby meeting, where I had people try and imagine like some life situation where prices actually change some significant decision in their life. And for almost everyone, there's something really big that came to mind pretty easily, like, you know, decision to buy a house. You know, is it worth it to kind of live closer to a busy road if it's worth this amount of money? And I think once you get people in the frame of mind of imagining how these invisible things actually happen, they become a lot more receptive to it. So I guess in thinking about the economic impacts, it's more about getting people in a frame of mind where they can accept that these invisible things happen. You know, one of the other things, too, in terms of economic impacts is also there's something, I don't know, maybe some people just don't kind of care about economic impacts as much as others. But one of the things that we can learn from the campaign on the climate skeptic side is what they're afraid of. And for the past, you know, year or two, the EPA has been on a kind of effort, has made an effort to discredit some science behind air pollution regulation. And their calculation is that this is one of the most powerful arguments in favor of climate regulation, that coal-fired power plants cause premature deaths, even if you don't think about climate change. So if they're truly afraid of that, then I think that's something that in lobbying for a carbon tax, we can exploit as well. The you know, the EPA has proposed some rules to ease regulations on coal-fired power plants. And the EPA's own study showed, I think it's probably conservative, that those rules would result in an additional 1,400 deaths. So, you know, economics or not, what would you do if you could actually put a name to those 1,400 people that are going to die prematurely, right? That's the sort of kind of, I think, exercise that gets people in a frame of mind where they might actually accept that there are certain things they can't see, certain things that, you know, economists and epidemiologists, other scientists out there are telling them are going to happen. What if you could actually make that real for them? And I think, you know, this is the job of thinking about economic impacts, is trying to make things that seem abstract to them seem real.
Great. Okay. So
does that make sense?
Yes, it makes complete sense. And I just want to make another pitch for your book. I think if you just listen to the way Schilling articulates certain arguments, you can see why his book is so compelling, because he just drops in your lap metaphors you can make that are very powerful and ways of communicating about this. So Ricky, okay. Can you just start with a couple of questions in the chat?
Yeah. So Mark, I think one of the questions, or the theme of questions we're coming in, is if Dr. Hsu could talk a little bit about the impact of the dividend and how it goes to consumers versus businesses and what that really can mean as far as driving the economy and helping small towns and local communities.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you kind of helped me focus on something. I think as Citizens Climate Lobby tries to work towards certain representatives and get certain people on their side, the dividend, you know, the dividend is the scariest thing for people that oppose a carbon tax, because this really helps rural communities, people that are kind of not as economically kind of thriving as other, as kind of many affluent people are the most. The idea of a flat fee, a dividend, has been around for a long time. It just took Citizens Climate Lobby to make this a popular concept. But the idea is this, you know, kind of you take the wealthiest households in the country, about a $30 or $40 carbon tax would probably generate about $2,000 dividend for an average household of, say, four people. And like the power of that is that, you know, take an affluent family of four, $2,000 is okay, but it's really not kind of something that changes a lot of decisions for them. But you take the vast majority of households that are kind of below the median in wealth, and rural communities especially, and $2,000 makes a big, big difference to those households. And you can imagine if you sit in a congressperson's office or in their kind of staff, you know, if you can just ask them to imagine how much $2,000 a household would mean to so many of their constituents, I think that would be very powerful. Just kind of back to the modeling part, you know, I think a lot of models have been done in the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, ironically, the states that would have the most people helped by the dividend are West Virginia, Mississippi, and Kentucky. And I guess, ironically, those are the states that come out the most strongly against the carbon tax and the carbon fee and dividend proposal. It's, you know, like I said, I think it goes back to trying to sell something that's invisible to people, that they don't have it front and center in front of them. And our job has got to be to put that front and center in front of them, if not directly, then to members of Congress and their staff, to say, you've just got to realize that this means a $2,000 check. Yes, it means higher energy costs. And yes, in states like Kentucky and West Virginia, the $2,000 might not get you back into a job. But for a lot of people in those states, $2,000 means a lot more than it does to your member of Congress, and even to the staff members that work for that member of Congress. $2,000 goes a long way for that people. And, you know, again, just to get them in the frame of mind to accept these things, you think you just, you know, take a thought experiment. If you were a struggling worker in one of these red states, and, you know, you were below the, you know, the kind of the national or state mean in kind of household wealth, what would they do with $2,000? Gosh, you know, they could buy shoes. They could buy prescription drugs. $2,000 could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And again, to kind of get them in the frame of mind of accepting that, maybe the best way to do that is just to kind of think from your own personal knowledge as volunteers of Citizens Climate Lobby, you know, what would I do with $2,000? I might buy this. I might do that. I might spend the money on this. And that might be the most helpful way to sell people on the power of the dividend.
Great, Ricky, got a couple more?
Yeah, I got one more question here. And this is more in regards to sort of the international landscape. And, you know, I guess if we were to do as well as to follow the path of our Canadian neighbors and do some carbon pricing, you know, how does that incentivize the rest of the world? If you can talk a little bit about that for a possible global plan or for other countries to come along as well.
Well, I hope that our Canadian neighbors, I actually am half Canadian myself, I have a dual citizenship, stick with the carbon plan. There's some political troubles afoot in Ottawa, and I am hopeful, but not necessarily confident that Canada will keep its carbon price. I think that, you know, one of the things British Columbia sort of did, I wish it did it more powerfully, was to show that the carbon tax that was instituted back in 2008 that ramped up over 5 years not only didn't do a lot of harm to British Columbia, there's some evidence that it really kind of was really pretty harmless to the entire province. The province certainly grew, and I think, to be honest, I don't think you could say that was due to the carbon tax, but I think you can say it is very, people have tried to find some sort of a negative effect of the carbon tax, and I think you just can't find it. I think at this point also, too, you know, it is worth, as Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers, to talk about kind of a rear guard action. There are groups out there that say the British Columbia carbon tax didn't work. It didn't reduce emissions. And on some level, you know, you can sort of say in a misleading way that, you know, emissions didn't go down that much. But again, it goes back to the arguing invisible things. What you have to imagine is what British Columbia would have looked like, what Canada would look like without a carbon price. And then emissions would be a lot greater. It is no small victory to say that a carbon price reduced emissions from what they would have been in British Columbia and would do that as well in Canada. What does it mean internationally? You know, I guess, you know, this could be an example for other countries to follow. There are carbon taxes, not just the carbon price, a carbon tax in about 15 other countries. None of them are particularly high except in Sweden, which is, by the way, a very, very economically successful country. They seem to have decoupled economic prosperity with carbon emissions. But I guess my feeling, I've never been particularly a big seller on let's learn from a carbon tax and use a carbon tax to kind of set an example for everyone else. I think we could probably be doing better by learning by example from what other countries are already doing, most notably, but not exclusively, Sweden.
The last question we've got for you is really about the impact of industries who really aren't directly consumer focused. So they're not really going to be benefiting, I guess, from direct consumer spending, but yet they'll see increased cost. What would you say to that?
Are you talking about like fossil fuel energy industries?
No, just other industries that might not be consumer based. They may like develop products for, say, they may be like a paper mill, right? And maybe they sell to other like book publishers or whatever. You know, how would they would have increased costs, but they don't necessarily directly sell to consumers.
Right, right. Well,
pushback or concern that we hear. So maybe if you could just help us address that, how do we address that?
Yeah, I mean, there are some industries that, I mean, pulp and paper mills would be affected, but, not as much as there are some energy intensive industries. What the energy innovation and what the energy innovation and carbon dividend act does do is to kind of try and equalize the international competition with the border tax adjustment, and try and make it for at least domestic manufacturers a level playing field if they're talking about competition from other countries. So, I think, these sorts of things are going to happen with a carbon price. I mean, the whole point of this is to change behavior. I don't know what to say to industries that are going to face these higher costs, except that, these things have happened before. I think if you look at a lot of other things, think about, if you're manufacturing in kind of a panhandle state, if you're manufacturing in one of these floodplains that now we learn are flood prone areas in the Midwest on the banks of the Arkansas, Mississippi, and Missouri rivers, a carbon fee cost is the least of the costs you face. Costs from, extreme weather, flooding, all kinds of productivity costs that your workers face because they may be sickened by things that were associated with climate change. These all are smaller costs than, the carbon fee and dividend cost would be a smaller cost than all the other things that climate change and the environmental degradation that comes along with carbon polluting industries impose upon manufacturers. So, it's a bigger pot that they're kind of stirring, but in the long run, the answer has got to be for manufacturers to get with a program that would to be part of a movement to reduce these other costs, rather than ignoring it, letting them kind of continue on and increase over time.
Wow, Shiling, thank you again. Every time you've hit it right on the mark, thank you so much. This has been so useful, and look forward to having you back real soon again and having you at one of the live conferences. You're certainly welcome to stick around for the next 10 minutes when we go over some of the things that happened since last month's call, but certainly understand on a Saturday if you want to drop off. But thank you again so much.
Okay, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure always.
All right, thank you. Okay, so I want to just go over a few things that have happened since last month's call. So there's been a dramatic increase in growth and membership in new groups at the beginning of this year. So up to 552 chapters and 139,856 people have signed up as members. The whole spring lobby drive, we ended up with 361 in-district meetings. That's well over 100 more than there were last year, which is just fantastic work. Okay, now this has to be one of the funnest ones to report we've ever had. So there were a group of people that have been working on getting endorsements from breweries. So they set up a game of to have 99 breweries give endorsements before the conference. We went over 99 last week and in fact hit 100. So for Jim, Randy, Steffi, everybody who's been working on that, that's just absolutely fantastic and also a whole lot of fun. Call-in day had more than 2,000 people more this year than last year. So for everybody who called in, that is just fantastic and thank you for doing that. There are 34 action teams tabling at this year's conference. We got our first appearance with our lead sponsor, Representative Ted Deutsch, with a fairly long interview with CNN. So that was very, very exciting. And for the first time ever, we got CCL comments on the record during the Ways and Means Committee hearing turned in by Representative Chu. And we are extremely grateful for that and excited to have gotten that in our first statement on the record in the Ways and Means Committee. We continue to add more and more people as bill sponsors on our committees of jurisdiction, including Ways and Means, which is really important. In terms of fee and dividend resolutions, Kansas City, Missouri, population just a little under 500,000, Charlottesville, Virginia, action on climate, Covington, Kentucky, and then also Palm Beach, Florida, Cincinnati, Hopewell Township, Narberth, Tremont, and Bayfield. So fantastic work in terms of building support for the bill in all kinds of communities all around the country. So what are we going to be doing this month? In Canada, we're going to be informing our MPs about seeking answers by the July 1st deadline we have for them, and then ongoingly is continuing to support our town halls that are coming up on October 7th. So in terms of the U.S., what are we doing? A couple of things. One is we're asking everybody to tweet your member of Congress, and if you've never done that, all the resources are available there on the action sheet. This could be your first tweet, and we know the impact social media is having, and we want to make sure it's being felt on the bill. And the second is, it's listed on your action sheet as plan a summer party, and I think one of the ways people have done this that have been great for them is they've had people who've been to the conference debrief, share about the conference, and the summer party actually ends up being both a kind of chance to connect, deepen your relationship with people, but have been really good outreach events. So I hope you noticed in the numbers that the diversity of our organization in terms of political spectrum, in terms of age, certainly in terms of people of color, 175 people coming from people of color, that we're more and more seeing this organization as an organization that more reflects what our country looks like. So we do decide to expand on our core values. So our core values we list are focus, optimism, relationship, integrity, personal power, and being nonpartisan. We looked to see if we could add diversity into all those elements, but thought it would be better just to express diversity as a seventh value. So we now list our seventh value as diversity. We empower everyone in exercising their personal and political power, regardless of race, ethnicity, nationality, gender, sexual orientation, age, religion, ability, or political affiliation. We seek out, support, and elevate people whose voices may not have been fully heard. So to our diversity team, I want to thank you for the great work that you did in putting that together. For those of you who will see here in DC, we'll see you soon. For those of you who are home, we know you've been doing an enormous amount of work towards pulling this event off, and we're reporting about results and live streaming. So I'll have Ricky unmute everybody so we could just wave to everybody and see you all either next time.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. B